This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Welcome to the award-winning Interest in Health and Safety podcast, making health and safety as important as everything else we do in business. And now, your host, health and safety specialist, mentor, and speaker, Colin Nottage.
Hi there, it's Colin Nottage here, and welcome to the Interest in Health and Safety podcast. Today, I am joined by Thomas Sproston. Thomas runs a business called Unit 10 Engineering, and they're basically a safety engineering business. So, you know, they've got an occupational health side of their business, but, you know, it's really about looking at sort of complex and difficult safety problems. And I'd like to introduce you to Thomas. Thomas, how are you?
I'm not so bad, thanks, Colin. How are you?
Yeah, no, really good, mate. Really good. It's really nice. Really nice to meet up virtually. We've not met or chatted before, but I've seen sort of some of your posts and bits and pieces on LinkedIn, and it just intrigued me, mate. And you know, so I thought let's touch base. Let's have a let's see about having a catch up and and see where it goes. Can you give us just a little bit of a bit about background about who you are?
Yeah, sure. My best place to describe my background is I'm Thomas Sproston. I'm a mechanical engineer by background. Achieved chartership in 2012, I think it was. Yeah, about 2012. My background is high integrity safety primarily. This is safety on complex products. I've done automotive, aerospace, trained planes, cars, essentially. Nuclear submarines is a big favourite. That's boats and ships and that kind of thing. So essentially managing design, safety of design of equipment in these contexts, looking at hazards associated with them, how they affect people operating them. And this essentially also the assets involved, but usually a lot of the time, because a lot of these things have to work for particular purposes. Say, for example, nuclear submarines need to find nuclear missiles. You need to stay hidden. So then they're quite equally important to maintain availability characteristics as well as safety. Things like ships, for example, you know, they need to float and do the objective of being a ship, as well as not damage the people involved on them as well. And equally, you've got things like environmental issues that come out of there as well, but that was not really my sort of bag. Yeah, I've done bits of nuclear safety as well. And so I've recently started moving into the occupational health and safety domain, primarily due to the fact that a lot of the work I've done over the last really 5 years has been varied between high level, platform level hazards, if you will, the very big facility type killer type thing, through to dealing with smaller stuff, because naturally as a duty holder you have to deal with everything, so they have to put cases together for your high level hazards and your lower level hazards. So hence I got trained to do some OH&S, realized there's an opportunity to go and work essentially close to home.
Yep.
There's
not many ships in Leicestershire, is there?
No, I mean my specialism isn't explicitly marine. It's just one of the things I happen to have done quite a lot of.
Okay, right, sure.
But because of where they are, it's all over the country. So I got sick of traveling. I was doing at one point 800 miles a week for work.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, you're sort of leaving work at sort of 4 a.m. on a Monday, not getting back till at least 6 o'clock on a Thursday. And you've done sort of 12-hour days for 4 days in between. You know, become immensely hazardous during the winter driving home. So hence having moments of thinking, well, can I work close to home? Well, yeah, I can go into the OH&S side of things. Mm-hmm. I was involved very heavily in fire safety for a period of time. In one of the projects I was doing mainly management of design integrity for fire systems, just things like firefighting water systems and various different varieties, and looking at the strategy behind how those are called in, considering that when you're on a boat, you are the emergency services. You have to do it in a structured manner. You can't just go, right, I've got a compartment full of people, I'm going to deploy this. This might be an AFFF foam system. You can't just deploy it then and there. You have to think about how it's done. You might go and say, well, first it's going to be evacuated. Mm-hmm. Then we'll go in with extinguishers. Then I'm going to go and deploy that when it's empty, mm-hmm. essentially. So hence I've done quite a lot of the early end firefighting strategy and looking at how you design your apartments to withstand this sort of thing. So I realized it was quite a good opportunity to do mainly fire work. So I did an FPA. Fire risk assessment course. I've done a few, mm-hmm. done a few fire risk assessments off the back of that since. I think I'm about my fifth now. From that, that's all low integrity stuff. And from there, because I gained a portfolio of doing lower hazard management, I did the NCRQ even diploma about 3 or 4 years ago now.
That's really popular, that that diploma, isn't it? It seems to have sort of become one of the main go-tos, I think, for people that are coming into the health and safety profession. I did my qualification many years ago, so long before that came along. But I think, you know, what's nice, I think, is it's you know, the qualifications now are starting to get much more focused, you know, away from all the technical, and starting to talk about some of the real stuff, you know, the people element. And I think there's still a massive way to go, but it's good to see that come in. So I think that was sort of one of the areas I think we were going to have a bit of a chat about today. I think was, you know, about talking about communication and what it is that the management team, especially the senior management team, maybe need to do to engage with the workforce a bit better. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, that sounds good. I mean, say it's one of those. The biggest thing is always the people involved at the bottom need to know what they're dealing with and why, and have to feel able to be able to make change to things.
Yeah,
it's weird that from my experience, I've come from it the other way, because I've got to make assumptions about the lower level, about the people using it, because I can't talk to hundreds of individual operators on submarines or on ships or on cars. I've got to assume them to an extent. But I've got to be able to convince the designers, people making decisions early on how we think these things are working and going to be worked. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be able to influence people into usually higher up the organizational chain within these contractors. You know, people like chief engineers and such, to say we want to do this and why. And it's often a different level of organizational influence to try to make that decision, so you can then essentially try and act as acting as an advocate for the people who are eventually be using it. It's quite subtle. So whereas when you do it in an OH&S context, it's more, you can call them together. You can say, well, okay, we want to do this. What do you think? And providing your duty holder understands that and understands the reason why, it's easier.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've just spent a couple of days up in Liverpool and working with an organisation up there. And we've just been going really back to basics with their, you know, with their risk assessment approach, and just getting the guys, you know, that I have one manager in the room on the 2 day sessions that we did. The rest of it was the lads from the shop floor, and really were just, you know, just challenging them a little bit, and, you know, just trying to find out what their frustrations were, and you know, what it was that what good looked like, but also what did issues and problems look like. And we did it, you know, we didn't want too many managers in the room, because sometimes that can, you know, that can sort of silence people. And we just really wanted to, you know, I suppose it's the start of a process. We're starting to open up a little bit and get them to be more comfortable to speak up a little bit. And it's been really challenging. One thing that you said though, and I'll be really interested to get your opinion on it, this influence of the designer. You know, how do you get the designers involved in the right way, so that they really get to take on the issues and the concerns of the people at the sharp end? Because I do a lot of work in construction, and the designers of buildings and stuff like that just tend to be so far away from the end user, so far away from the people that are building it, you know, and it just doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't seem to, just doesn't seem to gel enough. In the sort of sector that you work in, is it a better process, or have you got similar problems?
It's a bit varied. It varies much depending on the particular environment. In the defence industry, the Ministry of Defence like to actually embed people into organisations and second people in to support the design efforts. So we can call operational experience. So they'll say, well, you know how these things have been operated in the past. We can get some ideas how they operate in the future. Equally, private sector recruiters for that sort of sector like to look for people who use the product. Within things like automotive and rail, you can generally go and say, well, we've used the product ourselves, you know, we drive cars, we use trains, we understand what we can have access to maintainers for both quite easily. Mm-hmm. So having that lived experience is a little bit more straightforward, but you still got to, again, you're always based on a nominal assumption. And until you've got something that you actually, an actual tangible product, you can go say, well, this is what we've made our assumption, the risk assessments for. We now need to validate. In the case, you then pulling together a series of user panels, maybe to go and do some validations and assure that what you've done makes some sense. It's a little bit, vague, and it is always going to be fairly assumption based and fairly small sample based until you've got something out in the field in terms of a really big deployment. And it's one of those that takes time, but it's just that risk that you carry. You try and manage it as low as you can do, as early as you can do in the process, but you can't always do that.
No, I think it's some. You know, it's a really good point to raise there. We've in the last sort of 12 months, I suppose, launched an online system. I'll just mention it briefly before we came on the air. And you only really find out about it when people start using it. You know, that's when you can do loads and loads of testing and all that. But so what we've done is we've taken a small number of clients in our business and said, try and break it. You know, go out there, muck around with it, try and break it, see what works, see what doesn't work, and then we will change and adapt it. And I suppose that's, it's just really, really interesting. You don't realize what people are going to say beforehand, and there's so many great, great ideas and great initiatives and amendments that people suggest using the thing.
You'll be fine. You'll be adding functionality that comes out of your ears for reasons that don't make sense to you, but for one particular person, they'll be going, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
It's like when you look at the way I've noticed it casually in the automotive industry, there's the way some manufacturers approach maintainability, particularly in the engine bay, is intriguing. In some of them, it's a case of once the engine in, that's it, it's in. You can do very, very little. I mean, I best explain that. I'm a massive car buff. I take cars to pieces all the time. I've got a fleet of things myself. Right. It's like Volkswagen. They have a habit of their modern vehicles, past about 2005, they like to make it so the front end of the car physically comes away, so you can get access to the front of the engine, which is just mind-blowing, really, because it means that then they accept packaging limitations of actually getting everything in the same space. That's quite ridiculous, that some manufacturers have clearly gone, yeah, we've done it, but we haven't really thought about how it's going to be maintained. Mm-hmm. It's quite odd that I've seen the same thing happen in the aerospace industry, where I remember very early in my career, I was looking at human factors associated with an issue on starting an aircraft engine manually, because normally they're started from the cockpit or started from the ground with an air cart, but you have to do a manual maneuver to open a valve which is on the side of the engine. And naturally, this jet engine creates a rather large sort of suck when you start it.
Yep.
And so you can't have your operator stood next to it. You've got to be stood some distance away.
Yep.
To be able to operate this valve. It's only a small valve, but it's got a big crank handle on it, and you've got to open it. But naturally, when you're trying to turn that valve, if it's only, say, a 3-inch valve, but you're trying to open it from, say, 10 foot away, you've got all the flex in the pole to think about. And and then it ends up being from what's a gentle tweak to sort of 10, 15 kilos of pull. So come on then.
Yeah.
And so you can consider it during time, but it's very, very hard to go and estimate. And then you go and say, once you do deploy it, you might go and say, well, what if we've got a different operator that's, say, particularly weak, or we've got, say, a particularly strong operator that manages to, so we don't over-engineer the end of the valve or under-engineer the stick that actuates it such that people can do it, since it doesn't flex too much. It's hard. It's very, very difficult to cover all bases.
I think, that user ability is so important. I recently watched a video. I can't think what it's called now. You will probably know about it, but about how rubbish doors are, and how something as simple as a door can be really, really confusing if you put a handle on the side where you're actually meant to be pushing it.
I've been a victim of that several times.
But it's so, it's just, I'm just trying to, create that, create that user experience to make it easy, is really important. And if you don't achieve that, then don't be surprised if people do get things wrong, if people do make mistakes, because it can happen, can't it?
Yeah, well, similarly, a really big favourite of mine was back when I was in the aerospace industry. I discovered they wrote the aircraft maintenance manuals in simplified English, which I'm not too sure exactly what's between simplified and normal English is. I presume it's a smaller subset of language with emphasis on reducing complexity. Obviously, that would defeat the point of not being simple, but it is easy to understand. There's just less going on with it. Mm-hmm. And for something where you've got safety critical instructions, it's a very good way of looking at breaking things down and not adding additional fluff that we tend to do anyway, naturally out of habit. I mean, if you look at the way I speak, it's all over the place. It's like that. It's the same thing as adding push to a pull door. Mm-hmm. You can miscommunicate things inadvertently. Mm-hmm. Again, further complicated wording, but So it's simple English is a very good way of communicating simple, very complicated instructions. And it's it was one of those that I was stunned by the way that was used in some context.
So how do you how do you work with your clients then to try and improve the way that they can communicate?
It's generally a case of understanding what the messages are. It's of, I guess for me, a lot of the case, there's two major messages. You've got the messages as in pre-accident, if you will. What are we doing to prevent? How do we protect things from getting worse in the event of it actually happening? And then you've got the immediate post-accident. How do we recover? How do we get out? How do we get out of the building? That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's one of those that say for the planning beforehand, it's a lot of it's all sort of, I guess, communication subconscious, and it's a case of understanding, ensuring that the duty holders understand what they need to do by way of talking to the people involved and ensuring that things are put into place essentially. Mm-hmm. And then the back end is all quite simple. That's all a case of we have an instruction set. Familiarize yourself with it. If you need to refer to it, it's going to be written down in, we're talking bullet points, absolutely most here. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're talking presentation and simplicity of message, but it's a different thing completely. They're two completely different streams of things. So your communication in the early stage is all about active engagement and ensuring that people understand what they need to do and feel they can buy into the process. Where we say the after stage is all, this is what we got, you need to know it. Do not miss, this is all designed around failing, around misinterpretation, prevention thereof.
Have you got some examples then of where you've seen it done really well?
Depends on the view. Well, the early stage, the really early bit that we use, everyone, all of us sort of usually get involved in, say, all of us being health and safety type, usually get involved in the risk assessment side of stuff. The best sort there is the sort that you don't need to think about. I would always say, if you've proven that it doesn't need, you don't need to think about it, and you don't need to drag people into risk assessments, and they sort of willingly give you, you know, you've got a working means of capturing unsafe events and undesirable circumstances, that kind of stuff. And it just works because people know it's there and people understand how it works. And you don't need to talk about why. And there's no, oh, this again. That's the zenith. Really. If we could achieve that, that's good. But it's a tremendously hard thing to do. And that requires it from the top. You know, you need your duty holder to understand what they need to do and why it's beneficial to do it that way, in the sense of all the benefits of getting everyone engaged early. So that's the thing most people usually suffer with, particularly when they get big. I've seen so many instances of where large companies fail to get this to work, but that's because I've been at the bottom end of things. They've sort of said, well, for example, I've contracted for companies where they say you need to report events occurring. I've seen a number of events on their site. You go and report it, and they say, you're a contractor, you need to put it through your manager. And your manager says, yeah, we're not interested. You said, yeah, I'll report it. And then you find out they haven't reported it. That's clear, it doesn't work.
I think, it's interesting. You know, we had a bit of a discussion in the last couple of days about, just about reporting stuff. And this particular organization, they had a big, big push on numbers. You know, they wanted people to report so many things a day or a week or whatever it was. And I suppose it really became this quantitative approach rather than qualitative. And
what's the value in that?
None at all.
Limited, you know, best.
And this is the discussions that we had. And it's so much more important. You know, and I think, you know, don't get me wrong, they're not a bad company. You know, they're a really good company. They're trying to do things the right way. And I just think they've just got a little bit sort of caught up in things like bloody accident triangles and stuff like that, all that. You know, they think if we can get more and more of the stuff down the bottom, then the stuff at the top won't happen, without really thinking that if you want to stop stuff at the top happening, then have a look at what causes stuff at the top. Yeah. That's really where you need to spend your time. So it can be difficult. You can get caught up. But I like what you were talking about there, though, saying that, you know, if something just gets completed without thinking about it, without consciously thinking about it. I think because I think people do think about stuff, you know, then that can be a real success. But I suppose to achieve that, then you need people that really understand what they're doing.
Yeah, that's it. There's a lot more education in the early, whilst you're developing the process and trialing it and initially deploying it. But once it's in there, it's in. It's a case of you got a lot of pain early doors, and it's but once it's in, it's in. But that's the really, really hard thing is persevering with it when it's painful. This is a lot of people go, oh, it's hard. Yeah, don't do that. And this is when you go, oh, yeah, we'll get a consultant and they'll come and say what we need to do and fix it. And I go, yeah, well, we did it again. We got our documentation. We did risk assessments. And that was a year ago. And it's fine. No, it isn't. It's like I've been in situations where they've done their risk assessment, and you go and inspect the plant, and it clearly doesn't actually reflect the situation that's there. Mm. And then they've gone and said, well, we've got competent operators. Okay, what are you trained your operators to? What standard? Mm. We need to do a standard. Mm. Right, you've got three people doing the same job. How do you know they're doing the same job the same way? Mm. And do they understand the risks involved of doing it wrong? No. Okay. Yeah. And then your whole risk assessment falls over that point.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's also, it's about setting the boundaries and and allowing people to have flexibility within those boundaries. So, I'll give you an example. One of the jobs that we were looking at in the last couple of days has been removing a conveyor belt. And one of the guys said, well, we cut the conveyor belt in half, and then it drops over, each side of the head drum and the dowel drum, and then we pull it out. Yeah. And one of the other guys in the room, he says, I can't do that. He says, I have to cut it up into smaller bits to pull it out. And the first guy said, well, I can do it easily. And the second guy says, I struggle with it. And so I said, well, we don't have to be that specific that we say you cut it three times or you cut it four times. What we need to do is we need to just be comfortable that the way that you get that piece of kit out, you're comfortable with. And if you're doing that, so have a like a framework to walk, to rather than being really, really specific. So I think when you get really specific, that's when it's that's when it can fall apart. Yeah.
Yeah, this is where we start. This is where we've got that potential to talk about specific, suitable insufficiency. Because if you end up sufficient, it's about not being overly prescriptive, really, to an extent, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because you can't go too far down the rabbit hole. I mean, the biggest beef in my line of work, I say my line of work, my engineering safety line of work, has been we tend to go down massive rabbit holes of analysis, engineering wise. We tend to deal with events that are in the order of one in 10,000 years. Being the point we designed to, as in, we don't want to see events any more frequently than that. Things like, for example, nuclear reactors exploding, one in 10,000 years, minimum frequency. Mm. So, but to actually be able to justify that number, you have to do a fairly extensive amount of probabilistic safety, which is something I've done a very large amount of. I've done about 5 or 6 years of it full time. But it's a very hard thing to do very, very well before it starts getting ridiculous, because you start modeling everything under the sun. And again, this is where
does that one in 10,000 years come from then?
It's a number that was developed back in, I want to say, in the 1960s.
Right.
It's based on one tenth minus five per year. I can't remember where the exact zenith of it it's from, but that's the convention that the ONR uses within the I can't put it called. Just get me. Basically, where they judge a LARP adequacy to, really? To the basic safety limit.
So that's well before. Objective. Sorry, well before Jesus, if you believe in all that, and the pyramids, and all sorts of stuff, isn't it? I mean, it's
bear in mind asteroid impact is something like 10^-7, so they're a couple of orders down from that, but so. You've said, we're not going to ignore that, but 10^-5, which is still ludicrously small.
Is it?
And it's still clear it can happen, but when you look at things like Chernobyl, Chernobyl, there's another event in Japan, Tokaimura, back in the late 90s, and those are both primarily human error events. I mean, there's organizational safety issues all over the place with both of these, and Challenger as well. Mm-hmm. There's very few events in nuclear industry which have been caused by these very low frequency product type events.
Right.
Type things. It's always something else higher up the chain that you've assessed that's fallen through the gap is the favorite. Yeah.
Mm. It's how the people interact with it, I suppose, isn't it? You know, and the, and I suppose that's always the challenge that we've got, you know, and it's just an interesting challenge. I must admit, I would never, I would never use 1 in 10,000. So, no. You're right there, mate.
Yeah, I've done my stuff inadvertently. Disconnect my headset momentarily.
We're
back now.
You're back up and running. Fantastic. But what about the senior management in the business then? What role have they got to play in shaping and developing, you know, the way that the business moves forward?
It depends on the business and the nature of the risk we're dealing with. I hate to be evasive like that, but it really does. I mean, because for example, in a low integrity context, you know, you're safety, health, environment kind of practitioner sort of level with it, you know, the smaller business, even to medium-sized business, you know, it's the senior leaders have the entire portfolio. You deal with the entire hazards within the business. Mm-hmm. That is as simple as that. Whereas within your larger, so you know, you're as a consultant to somebody like that, you are there to try and tell them what they need to know about the law and how they can best get the best even out of their staff and their contracts underneath them to ensure that's delivered against what they want, you know, whether they want to achieve compliance with or in excess of. Mm-hmm. Within a more higher integrity context, it's slightly different. Your senior leaders of that business are there to ensure they deliver to the requirements of their customer, who should have said, we require you to meet standards of safety that are either in excess of the law or to a particular standard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very different problem that is because try and get understanding of safe. It's weird. It's kind of paraphrasing here simply for the reason that the motives vary. For example, in the rail industry, it's very cost bound. In the automotive industry, it's even more cost bound. Standards of safety in the automotive industry and the rail industry are completely different. The rail industry is more towards the nuclear level of safety in terms of approach and levels of safety achieved. The automotive industry isn't, but their cost binding is massive. They have to build products that are massively profitable. Mm-hmm. To ensure people, in terms of cost basis, to ensure people buy them.
Mm-hmm.
So massively profitable, massively, you know, their appropriate costs to ensure they get a profit margin and people want to buy them. It's not that expensive. But for example, if we go and dive down the rabbit hole of CAVs, autonomous vehicles and driver assistance systems, they develop those to us. The standards they should be using, given that they can end up with situations in terms of failure that end up what you term systemic, as in it's not random. It's due to something inherent into the coding of the software and the hardware that end up driving the systems, because it's systemic and it's not unique to one particular instantiation. You could have things occurring in very many different instances of the same equipment. For example, if you've built say 10,000 autonomous cars with software that you haven't developed the appropriate standards, which do exist, but it's something the industry is quite in practice reticent to pick up because it takes a lot of effort. It's a very, very large amount of effort. If they don't develop these standards, they deploy, I'm not going to say poor standard gear because that put me liable, but standards that haven't been, stuff that hasn't been developed to the same standards that need to achieve, ultimately it could have these defects and could it create liabilities for them later.
Mm-hmm. Does the automotive industry, you know, work together on safety?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, because my, you know, my background is quarrying, and you know, and the quarrying, there's a couple of trade associations in the quarrying industry that do loads and loads of work with the members to drive forward the health and safety standards, and it's really great to see it. You know, they don't always focus on the things that I focus on, but generally speaking, they do some absolutely amazing work. There's a similar approach in automotive. Yeah,
it's a bit more subtle than that. It's within the automotive. It's a case of the prime responsibility rests with the vehicle manufacturer.
Okay.
They use publicly available standards or develop their own standards, or they use, and they have to meet legal requirements from the areas in which they're producing vehicles for sale in. And then the vehicle approver. This is within the UK. It's called the VCA or what was VOSA, now V. DVSA essentially. Yep. Merged with the DVLA. they set the standards and they have to pass it off against that. But there are various user groups around, we'll say various industry groups that build standards and try and aim to improve integration between the two. But it's one of those that really rests with the manufacturer doing the right job at the right time. And there's a lot of cooperation within the supply chain. You can generally go from a vehicle of integrated equipment through, in terms of safety claim, or nowadays you should be able to, in terms of safety claim and safety argument and evidence, right the way down to the smallest producible unit that they bought in from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Which could be two or three supply tiers down, and software associated with it.
Mm. And then, so who's sort of responsible then for the testing? Then is that the manufacturer that they do their own testing, or is there like sort of central bodies that test integrity of stuff?
Again, it varies on the nature of the testing involved. There's some tests are done entirely in-house by the manufacturer. Some tests are done by things, bodies like Euro NCAP, or can't remember what the body in Africa's called, I'm afraid. But there's various different bodies internationally that do crash testing, that crash test certain systems on vehicles. Mm-hmm. There's certain tests that happen through what you call type approval that meet the regulations of the local authorities and, let's say, the countries involved.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, it's on the manufacturer to corral all that information and make a coherent safety claim out of it. But that equally is a slightly different matter. So it's slightly odd that the adoption of a safety case, if you will, in automotive is currently an entirely voluntary thing, which feels a bit weird to you and I. I mean, if you look at, say, in small integrity industry, we have to manage safety. We have to write it down for the most part. In higher integrity industry, particularly oil and gas, you have to have a facility safety case. Other facilities, you have to have facility safety cases, but the automotive industry only just picking this idea up per vehicle, and it's happening, but very, very slowly. I say very slowly. It's not very slowly, but it's developing, and it's developing slowly compared to the rest of the world. Is, if you see what I mean, considering that their maturity, their technology is somewhat greater than the rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
or the rest of industry. It's quite. It strikes me as being a bit weird, but.
So that's say, that safety case you're speaking about, you say per, is that per model or is that per vehicle?
It's per model.
Per model, right. Well, yeah. Okay.
Generally, it's one of those because of you. Well, in theory, you could do it per vehicle. It's something that it did always baffle me when I was working in the auto industry, why they couldn't dock particular details per vehicle and look at where you've had concessions in, you've had bits that don't meet spec in, and you've done a safety argument on it. You could potentially do a per vehicle safety case. There's a lot of work with it if you do millions of them, but.
Mm.
It's what that, I mean, it could go that way eventually.
What would be the benefit of doing that? Would there be any benefit, or does it just become a paper chase?
You definitely stand towards paper chasing with that one. I think you'd probably end up that way. But if you could identify eventually that there was an issue with a particular part on a particular vehicle, it means you can quarantine small and your rework to fix it becomes a lot smaller.
Okay.
But the amount of effort required to get there is potentially prohibitively large, so you'd have to look. You have to think about it and evaluate whether it's worth it.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at the same thing with if we go into this idea of building safety cases that's coming in, the same thing could happen there. That because of the way you're building from so many different components, essentially, and so many different parts that are corralling together and making arguments out of. If you get an issue with, say, a block in, or say an aircrete block that's being used or something, or say a piece of particular variety of plasterboard that the manufacturer announces a defect with, how does that affect your safety claim throughout the building? Does it not? The reality is that you're going to be in your, well, we've got that sits X in our, that sits in X place in our chain of events, our bow tie of accidents, and so events have got other defenses, but making that claim and understanding how that all stacks up is an interesting problem.
I suppose what it starts to do is it just starts to clarify how much overlap there is between, you know, good health and safety performance, good quality performance, you know, good environmental performance. I mean, all these things go together. You know, my experience is that businesses that don't do, you know, environment very well probably don't do health, safety, quality and financials very well. You know, yet businesses that do one of them well probably have a pretty good stab at everything that they're trying to do. So but there's a massive overlap. Do you think there should be more? You know, do we need things like, you know, 9001 and 14001 and 45001 and 45003 and all the other standards that are out there? You know, do we need them all, or Could it be done differently?
I'm all for an integrated management system, but I think you've got to have the ability for people that really understand that particular speciality to go and dive in and out as they need to. Mm. It's one of those that you could foreseeably take bits of all your standards, mash them together into one great big thing that says, in general, we manage it like this, yeah, with particular sort of call outs on the side for this is safety, this is environment, mm, this is quality. And it's one of those, I mean, you can see that there's a lot of the ISO, I'll spit out to ISO, and for the reason that I know there's certain standards that do it, they do work like that to an extent, but it's one of those that actually stitching that picture together is an absolute and utter bloody nightmare, mm, because there's that much of it, and you end up saying, well, what standard are we at now? Oh, no, we're not in that one, this one. And then you end up, why are we working with this one here? Oh, we don't really know.
That's the thing, isn't it? You know, and it's I think for me, when organisations and when businesses are looking, to put stuff in place, for me, it's why, why are you wanting to do it? Are you a quality system? Are you wanting to do a quality system because ultimately you want to get really better at what it is that you're doing? Or is it because you're getting pressure from one of your suppliers or one of your customers? What is the reason behind it?
Well, that's it. I found myself in exactly the same trap earlier in the year because I was looking at going to get ISO 9001 certification simply for the reason I want to bid for bigger contracts. And it's one of those moments of, do I need it? Well, not really. There's me. It's not any value having a quality system because it's only me that's affected by it. Mm-hmm. And although the contract says you need one, yeah, but it's me. And I know I need one when there's more of us doing the same job, but until there's more than just me, it's very, very difficult for me to justify getting any value out of it. And I'm just doing it for the sake of having the paperwork.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
Unless it's actively being used, you're just wasting your own time and money.
I mean, of all the standards out there, I think for me, the quality one is the one that offers most value if it's done properly. Yeah. If you do it properly, then it can really transform the way that you think about how your business works. But
you say that there's other standards out there I've used that really, you think if you apply it properly, I'm going to be sunk if I do this. Things like there's BSEN 61508 and 61511, and there's I want to say 61513. There's also another, but these are specific functional safety standards for development of hardware and software and on plant where you've got risks to safety. Mm-hmm. And the amount of work some of these bits infer, some of these standards infer, I mean, essentially it's a standard set. The standards, so it's a set of three that all work in broadly the same way with the subtleties here and there. They say, understand what your plant is, assess your risk, put in some safeguards, assess your risk, understand what standards out on a size scale they need to achieve, and what sort of risk reductions you need from your safety measures, implement your safety measures and validate them. And it's the validation stage of it that really is the killer with it, because it's a case of, if you're at the highest integrity rating, you should do X, Y, and Z, but you can make your own decisions on the matter to an extent. Mm. And then because you've got, because you then look at measures as well as not only on the equipment in question, also to do with your organisation, you then get to say, well, we've got all this grab bag of stuff we've looked at. How do you make a coherent case against it? Mm-hmm. Or a coherence case to say it meets it? Because the standards don't require you to shepherd it together and make an argument out of it. It just says you got to do it. So if you do it, it's great. But the central person would say, well, we've got to meet this level. What can we do to achieve this level? Mm-hmm. How can we do it sensibly without inferring massive amounts of effort? And so they end up having to make an argument about it, really, and justify the safety of your equipment rather than purely collecting evidence and say it's made objectively.
Mm. What what industries do you think have really got this right then? Who is doing stuff really well, and what could we learn as general safety practitioner, which I'm pretty much, I've got some specialism in quarrying and silica dust and stuff like that, but generally speaking I'm quite a generalist in what I do. What can we learn from the people from the organizations and the sectors that get things really, really right?
I don't think anyone's got it bob on right, to be honest. I think it's one of those things that the more I look at it, the more I have moments of, oh!
Right.
The biggest thing with a lot of complex safety cases, they love boundaries. They like to say, we're only looking at this, and they fall over massively with where their boundaries fail in between organisations who are delivering things, and also where they've internally bounderized things. As in, say, you've got, we're dealing with this, we've got a bit inside here that's been dealt with by somebody else, and where you've got transitions, between two, they always fall over there. The biggest thing in, I would say if you look at things like the whole thing with Boeing the other year, and well, say Boeing particularly with the 737, that was a massive organizational failure. No safety process in the world, particularly the one they're working to, which is the called ARP 4754 and 4761, that wouldn't have found it. There was a decision made saying we're going to reuse it, essentially, and they're going to reuse it. And it was just a blind reuse if we're going to reuse this kit off a different piece of aircraft in a different context. And we never really fully assessed it. And that was how it was. That was the root cause of how that was missed. And then there was a whole, once it was identified, oh, well, it's too late. We got the thing in development. So, yeah, you know, even if you go good, went down the high integrity, we must assess everything about it. It's still going to have its pitfalls, but you know, it still comes down to the basic question of how do you engage your people? Mm-hmm. How do you ensure people know what they're dealing with? Mm-hmm. Because somewhere along the lines, a number of people in Boeing stood up and said, "Yeah, this is wrong," and there was silence, organizational deafening.
Mm. Yeah, and that's you know, having the confidence to speak up is really important. But having the intellect to listen is even more so, you know. Yeah. Because there's a lot of people that raise things that talk things, and then they don't get listened to, or they don't get responded to, and so what it does is it just drives them back to silence. You know,
yeah,
what's the point?
Yeah, that's it. Once you get to that, what's the point? It's futile. You've got to go back to square one, start again.
Yeah, and businesses shouldn't be frightened to do that. You know,
Well, it's inherent in Plan, Do, Check, Act, isn't it? Yeah. Page 63, go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, go again.
Go again and try again. So what have you got? Anything exciting coming up in the next few weeks or few months that you're working on that you want to tell us about?
I guess the major thing for me, I'm trying to plan a very, very complex hazard assessment project for a client, which is just proving very, very complicated.
Right.
It's just one of those. There's lots of different organizational facets to deal with. It's sat within a really odd consultancy environment, and it's in terms of how it's being delivered, and it's figuring out how the organizational boundaries to that work that's going to be the crux to make it work effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual doing the job and assessing the hazards of this particular application is going to be either very straightforward or not.
Right.
And yeah, that'll be for a fun job.
Yeah, no, I mean that's it's really fundamental, and getting those boundaries. You know, a lot of what we try to do is this risk profiling process, and just really trying to understand, you know, what is it that people are facing. You know, once you've got a steer on that, then you can start to work with them in the right way.
Yeah. And
start to work on the things that are important.
Yeah, it's the whole what do you have to achieve and what do you want to achieve, isn't it? And then,
yeah.
Then so what else is there? You know, is there any other things that might be relevant?
Mm-hmm. So how can people get a hold of you then if they want to?
The easiest way is probably through the I've got, I'm very active on LinkedIn. I've got a LinkedIn profile for me and also my company. I'm a bit late for the plug, but I run a firm that's called Unit 10 Engineering. We currently trade as a Westley Lansdown, which is for the occupational health and safety side of things. Very accessible through the website there, which is www.westleylansdown, which is westleylansdowne.co.uk. Or you can get hold of me by, that's probably it, really. Is via LinkedIn or the website for the best way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think LinkedIn works for a lot of people, doesn't it, nowadays? You know,
it's very convenient, isn't it? So,
yeah. So yeah. Please check out Thomas Frosten. Thank you ever so much for coming on. And, it's been really nice chatting with you.
That's been good.
Thank you so much for your time, Thomas. It was really lovely to chat to you, and since we recorded that episode, I've also had the pleasure of meeting up with you in Leicester when the Health and Safety Network got together. So, you know, thank you so much for your support, and you know, and just thanks for, you know, what it is that we spoke about. You know, really trying to get to the bottom of some of these detailed and complex and difficult health and safety problems. In actual fact, if you do it in an organized and arranged and robust way, you know, it can be really, really beneficial. You know, and if people have got something, you know, that's in, you know, some of the more complex industries, you know, such as nuclear, and you know, you mentioned about doing a lot of work within automotive engineering and that kind of stuff, you know, then please reach out to Thomas, because he's got some you know, he's just got a really nice way of thinking, and you know, sort of getting that clarity to sometimes things that can be quite awkward and quite difficult. You know, thank you very much for listening to the show. We'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Health and Safety Network. You know, if you're new to the health and safety profession, or you're you know, at a bit of a crossroads, or maybe getting towards the end of your profession, and you want to give a little bit back, then the Health and Safety Network is for you. It was formerly called Project Miletium, but people couldn't say it or spell it, so we've you know, we've gone back to something really simple, the Health and Safety Network. You know, please check out healthandsafetynetwork.com. And, you know, become part of a growing community of really, really exciting people that are just looking to make a difference, and looking to challenge the way that we do things and just make things, you know, just make things better for the people in the workplace. Hey, speak to you soon. Bye-bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Interesting Health and Safety podcast. You can follow and engage on Facebook and LinkedIn by searching the Interesting Health and Safety community, or go to www.influentialmg.com. And remember, let's make health and safety as important as everything else we do in business. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guests, and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No parts of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Colin Nottage.